bit about the anomalies and I'm not going to say anything more until I get into the details of it, but you know the story. There is the famous cold spot, and it's a rare event, in spite of some people thinking it's just a random throw of the dice. The dice have to be loaded to get the cold spot. There are other interesting structures, and the question is whether these are going to survive the tests of time. So far they have, and there is certainly a coherence between the different experiments that have been done, and I'll be showing some of the information for that. There is a power spectrum asymmetry, and it's a non-trivial thing. It's at the 7% level at low L. It's unclear at the moment whether there's any power asymmetry at high L, and there's been much healthy discussion about this over time. There is a modulation that does exist of the power associated with the Doppler term, and that's been observed, and it's been observed with high significance at 5 sigma in one of the Planck papers. As you know, when you do pattern recognition at high L, the non-Gaussian patterns that are of specific forms that we know and love, including FNL, are quite restrictive. And so there was a tendency for people to, of course, there was an industry of calculations of such things, and it took a bit of the wind out of the sails of those people, but of course, theorists are quite resilient, and so there are people reconsidering that, and there are openings for one to consider, and I'll be going through some of those openings of from a theoretical perspective. one of the things we're very interested in, as you shall see, is where the measure of curvature fluctuation, zeta, nonlinear there, may have contributions that are statistically independent of the usual inflation-induced zeta, and that this can actually be relatively large as long as it's subdominant. And many of the measures that are used to come up with the pattern constraints on non-Gaussianity are largely based upon a relatively perturbative framework where they're but where it's still dealing with the more or less the same field that one is, in other words, the inflaton curvature fluctuations is a nonlinear correction, and that has to be small, at least at the high L limit. But if you can have something that we are calling intermittency, I've been calling this for an infinitely long time, and I'll explain that in a bit more detail, then these measures depend upon the support of that auxiliary field's curvature fluctuation. And if that support is small but non-trivial, it would be observed more like a source, an extended source, than something that's ubiquitous over all of the sky. And in particular, the measures that are being used, and it have been much touted and one of the great results from Planck, they go like the support of that nonlinear term to the cube power. And so if you make the regions not too huge, then that number will drop, and it isn't the right pattern recognition way to go after that kind of non-Gaussianity. And, what's that? I mean, if I have a field, so let's say I have this will become clearer, but if I have the inflaton-induced curvature fluctuations of Gaussian random field, and then I have sort of splotchy things that are occurring on the sky with power localized in those that are really subdominant, then the support would be the region that they are actually bursting on. And we'll see a mechanism for that. The mechanism is I can point to my good friend Jim Bardeen here, who I'm delighted to see. It's essentially a super bias form of action on a random field, as we shall see. So one of the frameworks for dealing with this is, of course, the inflaton is one field, But the expectation is that there are going to be lots of other fields that will be around, and do they do anything? If the fields are light, then they get the quantum fluctuations like every other field. Those are isocurvature degrees of freedom. If they're heavy, they've got different kinds of action, and you can use both of them to good effect in trying to think of the phenomenology of inflation. And so some of the key words in this that we'll be going through in this talk are modulated heating associated with ultra-large scale structure in the isochron degrees of freedom compared with this inflaton one. And key terms that arise in this are what the trajectories are in the heating process for the various fields, how they evolve, and we'll see there's a really interesting phenomenology that we found. We had advertised this a number of years ago in work with my good friend Lev Kaufman. See Shinji in the audience, hi Shinji. It's ballistic chaos in terms of how actually effectively orbits occur in field space at the end of inflation. But the thing that we have identified quite recently, and it involves this group of authors here, including Jonathan Braden, who's in the audience and is a brilliant guy, Andrei Frolov, another brilliant guy who's in Moscow right now, and Shiji Wang, who's in Paris right now, but he's coming back to CETA for a postdoctoral fellowship. What we found is that caustics play an extremely important role in this phenomenology of ballistic chaos, and so we can now understand at a really deep level, we think, this concept of modulated heating. There are other ideas associated with this, with when nonlinearity really breaks open. We call it the shock in time. Essentially what happens, it's very much like a shock in that before it you have almost like Mach number flows into a time surface, and after it you get a huge amount of entropy generation, and it's got some characteristic width of entropy production, very much like a shock. So we have modulator fields, and one of my favorites are axionic degrees of freedom that would be, I will not ever call them spectator fields, because they actually are do or can do important actions. It can manifest itself in the effects of fields like that on coupling constants, etc. And what is key about this, I'm basically giving you a précis of the entire talk, so when I run out of time, you will have at least got some idea of where I'm headed and where we're headed. One of the curious features about the isocurvature fluctuations, if they aren't extremely heavy, is that in principle you can access what they were like outside of the horizon. It's only with one throw of the dice, to be sure, so that not only would they have within the horizon, have had within the horizon fluctuations that can leave an imprint, but they would have these super duper ultra large scale fluctuations. And that would be, in effect, a random variable for our patch of the universe if you can access it by some mechanism, and this modulated heating is a way that one could access it. So another whole brand of intermittent phenomenology associated with non-Gaussianity is in the uber quantum tunneling landscape, of which there is great hopes and probably a lot of dreams, in the sense that the natural response will be the probability of having a bubble collision, for example, within our horizon is a small thing. It doesn't matter. If you've got the data, you got to look for these things. But we will try and give a scenario in which there's a possibility of that being maybe even not as improbable as the standard results, and we'll show some results for bubble-bubble collisions. Okay, so the one issue is there a cosmological framework for all of this interesting intermittent phenomenology? Obviously, bubble collisions would be intermittent in that it would only be a localized region of space over which it's happening. Okay, so to explore all of this, you really require very sophisticated computer programs, because you can only marginally intuit what's going on. The nonlinear multifield dynamics is a fabulous subject in its own right. And one uses lattice simulations, and I have the fortune, good fortune, of working with three brilliant numerical colleagues. And the workhorse for our collaboration is a symplectic code in first written by Andrei Frolov, but with lots of action from Braden and in a different context by Wang. And Jonathan Braden has also developed, just in the last short time, a new spectral code, which instead of operating in lattice space, which it still makes use of, it tries to solve Laplacians in momentum space, and it can be very, very good for some calculations. So the story is an intermittent non-Gaussianity, which is a statistical landscape of possibilities that may or may not turn out to have to be related to the world that we see, but it's certainly possible. No. That's what I that you are going to go into the next level of my talk. So I will show you what I think the current situation is. And I would say, although these phenomena have been with us for a long time, stay with us, and that I think myself, there's a certain blindness on people's part that look at these things and they say, statistics, dice throwing. And yet they're just sort of leaping out at you. And so, you know, you have to be really careful because the critical thing is whether there's a systematic or foreground or something that we haven't properly taken into account. That's really probably where the effort has to go in terms of putting this on a firm foundation. And as you know, there's a problem. The problem is that there are only so many modes that these are connecting with, and so there is the statistical random chance possibility, but there are some real rare events that are non-trivial here, and some of them may go away, and there's something I'll talk about there. So I'm going to try, and many of the people in this room were actually at the extended KITP primordial cosmology workshop that we had, and I went for two extended periods, and these topics of non-Gaussianity, anomalies, etc., were very much on the table, much discussed. It wasn't the only thing being discussed, but it was heavily dealt with. Names like Hirata, Komatsu, the ones in blue are the ones of most relevance to this particular talk, apart from things that my collaborators talked about, which are intimately related to what I'm going to talk about right now. And this is sort of a take two of what I talked about just a little over a week ago, 2 weeks ago maybe. You can see Kendrick was there, Dan Green was there, and all of these. Kleppen was there talking about bubbly things. You know, the usual cast of characters, Anthony Lewis, Duncan Hansen talking about power modulation. Gorski and Erickson were doing it for isotropy, and those were really fascinating discussions. This was in the general meeting. There was also, in May, when I wasn't there, there was a very large class of discussions about what you might call, even though it's been on the table for a while, a new regime for non-Gaussianity, which is the recognition, obvious recognition, is that the number of modes, if you add the radial direction, that is to say you can do tomography, the number of modes in a 3D survey are so much bigger than in the microwave background. So if you can control the very, very large systematic, in principle, you can do quite well in the non-Gaussianity. And of course, that's a subject of a lot of people's interest. Okay, so just to remind ourselves of the anomaly story, this is the SMICA map, which essentially extends through the plane using the 9 frequencies of Planck to try and do cleanup of the foregrounds, you know, the unveiling story. There were 3 other component separation methods, and one of the triumphs of Planck that we much tout is the stability under these different methods. Of course, the methods are not that radically different in a way. And so you have to be careful that you aren't fooling themselves for sheer number of component separation methods. And I'm going to draw your attention to the cold spot down here, but also these remarkable structures that are occurring through the plane. And the issue is, can you believe anything that's got any that's happening anywhere near the plane? And so that's the open issue we have on the anomalies. And one of the things which was really a great unveiling, it doesn't surprise one because I already had been showing things like this before, but what the WMAP team did, they took their map and they applied the 353 gigahertz Planck map to add a further template to further clean WMAP. And so the issue is, how does WMAP visually compare with Planck? That's it. Look at that. You should be startled and exceptionally pleased by how well on these scales all things are done and how amazingly stable these anomalies are. Okay, that's cleaned with the 353, as I said. And when you go into smaller regions, you ask yourself, how have the other experiments done relative to Planck? These are not so much probing the anomaly regions, which is a shame, and eventually it would be nice to do a little more targeting of that, but there is really superb agreement with ACT, and we're going to hear about all of this from Renee, and SPT. You know, it always looked like there was a bit of tension, but you know, in broad brushstroke and even in fine detail in the overlap regions, the agreement is absolutely spectacular. We are obsessing in Planck and in the WMAP team with the residual 1.2% difference in delta T over T between Planck, HFI, and LFI, which are in pretty good agreement, and WMAP. So this is the big issue on the table. And my view of this is, yes, we will solve it, and we have to solve it, because you want to make use of, for example, WMAP's 22 gigahertz in collaboration with the Planck results. I mean, Planck plus WMAP is a great thing, as well as Planck alone. So it has to be nailed, it will be nailed, but we sure haven't nailed it yet. And so that's a residual point. But it doesn't take away from these large-scale structure agreements. This is without the 353 cleaning of WMAP. Of course, the color combination has changed, but you can see that as well, we still have these anomalies. And they were even, as you know, observed in COBE. So this is the cold spot, and then these are that remarkable structure occurring through the plane. And of course, then we would essentially dismiss it and say it's too close to the plane, it's clearly an emission, we don't have enough frequencies. Now you would say, ah, but we have 9 frequencies with Planck. But you have to be careful about that because, you know, a certain amount of the cleaning is on the radio emission side, synchrotron, et cetera, and a certain amount of the cleaning is on the dust side. And the question is the dust side really responsible for what's being cleaned out in order to be able to do this? And that's not clear to me. The other thing that occurs is that there is a different emission than people have usually taken into account, which is called anomalous microwave emission, probably due to spinning dust, which has got a different frequency structure. So you have to be careful that we've really nailed the foregrounds. So all of these issues are on our table. One of the things which will be great in the future is that Planck has polarization. And the next release is going to be very much a polarization focus. And we should be able to look at the polarization structure of anomalies, and that's an independent exploration of the nature of the anomalies. So I'm going to talk about very quickly about a graph, which is the power spectrum against K. This kind of thing will, I think, Martin will be talking about, but I like this because it shows the power spectrum reconstructed actually with consistency assumed, but it doesn't really matter if you do. over a broad range of scales using 9 knots in a cubic spline expansion. And as you know, there's no strong evidence for features or anything in the background. This K-space regime corresponds to a little tail around here for L around 22 and 1800. And if you've read the Planck papers, you know there's a hint of anomaly here and here. This is not probably a stable anomaly, but there is a feeling of the data to try and do something in response, in particular, an attempt to steepen, but the trouble is the random throwing of the dice becomes such that the cosmic variance is opening up the set of allowed trajectories that are possible. These are 1 sigma trajectories. The thing that was amazing to me is how perfectly this 9 parameter thing locked in to exactly the NS that was the best fit from Planck. So this is a remarkable thing, and it's a reminder of the first thing to draw from Planck is that our whole parameter story is largely dictated by this regime, which is of higher L, and the low L anomalies are not driving the parameters. And so the fact that everything's locking into lambda CDM is in effect a high L story with some interesting and important issues associated with the lower L part, in particular, the limit on R, which is associated with it. Okay, so then there's the standard FNL, and I'm not going to get into this. But one minor thing is when you do a degree scaling, almost all of the information is in this, which looks like white noise, and this is the larger scale. So all of the anomaly structure is in the L's below, in this case, about 134, and all of the amazing information comes from something that looks almost like white noise. It isn't, of course, if you go into it with much higher resolution. So, of course, there's been much discussion over the years about the anomalies, and the WMAP doctrine, as enunciated by Bennett et al. For WMAP 7, is that it's all more or less a figment of your imagination. Not entirely true, but certainly they did the inflammatory search for the, I made it explicitly small here, that if you do pattern recognition on SH, Stephen Hawking's initials, you would find them in the sky. Well, I would say that maybe you think there's brilliant motivation for doing that, and that such a pattern search with orientation angles is a really good thing to do in scaling. But, you know, but they were using that and using something else as arguments against actually doing blind searches for remarkable entities within the data. So there are cold spots. These blue things are cold spots. And they said, well, you know, we can make them arbitrary shapes and we get these remarkable things. And that is a true statement. But if you can, you know, do whatever drawing you want to do, that's true. And that would not be a blind search for structure because there are probably too many degrees of freedom unless you have a theory of them looking like this. The thing that you can do is go in and do some kind of blind search for extended structures, just like you do when you look for the Sinyaev-Zeldovich effect. When you look for the Sinyaev-Zeldovich effect, you have a specific spectral structure, and the Sinyaev-Zeldovich structure, and then you go with the varying scales to try and see where the objects might be. And if we didn't have X-ray or optical observations before, we would have discovered the objects, and it would have been a well-motivated search. Well, now we're looking for structures that have a scale associated with it and a specific frequency structure, which is just delta T flat. To try and say that that's an after-the-fact statistic and you would never have done it before is, in my view, just silly. And then the other aspect of that is that taking a random field and using a resolution direction, which is called scale space, is not just It's actually sort of a standard approach in any statistical framework at all. So I think that all of those arguments are kind of silly from my perspective. Okay, so we have these things, and I really don't know what to make of those things there. There's a very curious thing. You all know about the quadrupole-octupole alignment. It's not quite as severe as it was in the WMAP9 data, but what is so interesting is that the quadrupolar structure is obviously feeling these anomalies right here that are extending through the plane, and at some level, so are the quadrupole. What is the meaning of that? I don't know. And what you would like, though, is probably some grand unified theory that would do it all simultaneously. If you take away just the quadrupole and the octupole, then you actually end up with the sky, which is sort of more reasonable. Okay, then you can look on hemispheres of the sky, or actually disks. You can do power spectra, and then you can say in which direction are the power spectra maxima, in which direction are they minima, and this is the dipolar direction, and this is the 7% anomaly that I was talking about. So that's another interesting aspect. Okay, so how seriously are we to take all of these things? Well, my view is that theorists have to have something to play with, and the standard FNL from the pattern recognition on the simplest models is not as exciting a thing to work on after Planck as it was before Planck. That doesn't mean one should forget about it. It's still very interesting. One aspect of that is that there was at least a hint of possible scale dependence of the non-Gaussianity of Planck, and that will be much more explored as we penetrate the data even more, and it connects to whether or not there's any residual radically broken scale invariance that exists within the Planck data. So that's an interesting aspect, which is the way that I used to think that non-Gaussianity would most likely manifest itself, which is that it would choose a characteristic scale, maybe have some kind of symmetry breaking an m squared equals zero direction, sometimes called tachyonic, and that would sort of build in a characteristic scale. But now there are these other methods from end of inflation, preheating, and they deal with intermittency. So intermittency, I've already talked about bubble collisions. There is another aspect of end of inflation. Of course, there's been a long issue whether there are residual cosmic strings or other defects that might occur and that could manifest themselves in the sky. And of course, this has motivated the Planck search for the strings without success so far. But as well, at the end of inflation, you can produce string-like entities that store energy, at least for some period, before they sort of may fade away, and so there's another interesting phenomenology associated with that, a different aspect of stringy things. Okay, I'm not going to talk, I think I'm going to skip over this so I get to some theoretical aspects. I was going to show you cold spot things, but the cold spot's there. There is no question about it. We think we have the best method for going after it. This is with Froloff, Jonathan, out there, Wang, Nolte, and it's nice because we're doing direct comparisons with the formula that George Stathio and I came up with in 87. It's different than what our Planck paper did in the sense that they were interested in, Minkowski functions in particular areas of pixels that are above some threshold, which is like excursion sets, and that's a good thing to do. But what we're explicitly looking at are peaks in a hierarchical structure associated with peaks in the field, and that's the thing that we're doing a comparison of. And at the best possible resolution scale, there's a high significance to the cold spot. It's just not going away. I'm gonna skip over this nice figure, just look down here. So this is emergence as you change the filtering scale of the cold spot. Skip over that. skip over that. This is something showing significance as a function of scale. So now here is the entire universe evolution in one plot. I will always play to the audience, which seems to think my figures are a little complicated. This, of course, is the scale of the horizon. This is ultra early universe, inflation going through preheating. The characteristic co-moving scale in preheating is about a centimeter co-moving, producing this. We get the cosmic web, and we get a rather unhappy future unless something strange happens in terms of the acceleration of the universe at late times. But as you know, we can take the information that we get here and we can project back and do all sorts of calculations, believable or not, in terms of what the uber structure of the universe is. Here is the sort of stochastic framework, stochastic inflation framework with all sorts of Laune bubbles. But then there are the quantum tunnel bubbles that are also part of the framework, both somehow interacting together. Usually they're not much discussed together for some curious reason, which I don't understand. Anyway, that's a story that you are all aware of. So the modulated preheating is all associated with this, but with the large scales being defined in terms of the ultra-large movement of the isochron fields here. Say that again? I mean, this. No, it's T.S. Eliot. Yeah, would that it were mine, I'm afraid. there should have been pattern recognition because it's one of the most famous lines around. Okay, anyway, so we do these calculations, and we actually do the calculations in great detail, and we can predict the intermittent nature of the sky. This would be a sky with some intermittency structure associated with this isochron modulated preheating superimposed upon a Gaussian random field, which would be the inflaton. And although it wasn't arranged to be aligned with where anomalies would occur here, but you can see that there is sort of a bursting up that occurs and structural elements that wouldn't be entirely dissimilar from here. Here is what lies underneath of that, without the Gaussian random field. And so what you see are these intermittent bits of power bursting up. And the question is, can that subdominant phenomena help to explain the anomalies? And if not, what are the constraints on that form of non-Gaussianity, quite different than the usual FNL? Oh, okay. And you can get the sky being quite different. Oh, yeah. I won't get into the details of this, but here is the underlying isochron field. Here is the curvature response to that underlying field. There are all sorts of spikes that occur in this. You can hardly see it in this. I can hardly see it, so you can probably hardly see it. It looks like a spectrum with all sorts of responses. But if you marginalize over the short distance phenomena, you make an effective field theory, which turns out to be quite accurate, which is this sort of smooth thing with a zoom that looks something like this. So here is the isocurvature field. Here is the response here's the isochron. Here is the Laune A or curvature response to that, or zeta response. And so what happens is you take a value, and then you get this is the multiplier to give you the field. And so what you can see is you have a remarkable structure. And one of the key parameters here is the value of the isochron field outside of the horizon, which determines where you lie on this sort of response curve. And then around it are all of the large-scale fluctuations. And so what you're doing is you're probing a region around each of these, and it's a random statistical number which value of this you've chosen. So you could be here, you could be here, you could be here. Now, an interesting thing to do is to go back and translate these back to the origin. And so what you get are these various curves that are rising with various structure, and it is very similar to the theory of biasing that Jim Bardeen and I worked heavily on once upon a time, thresholding functions. And what can happen with that is you can get extremely rare events, and that is the phenomenology of this. And this is what happens, this picture, to these patterns as you sweep over different values. And so you see that in some cases you get some things happen. In this case, you would have a lot of phenomena that would be subdominant here. It's fairly rare. And so you can see that you've got this control parameter, which is changing the response. And also we have other control parameters, obviously the structure of the potential. Okay, I was going to go into this to say, why doesn't it look like the biasing we know and love, which is the biasing of clusters of galaxies and bias of galaxies, et cetera? It's basically because the density power spectrum, the power spectrum is quite different. With the clusters, you're probing the density power spectrum, but with the ultra-large structure, you're super-duper structure, you're probing the zeta power spectrum, which is essentially flicker noise. In fact, it's a little red relative to flicker noise. And so what that means is that you are taking really long wave things and you are doing this biasing, which is shoving them up. And so that explains the structural difference. That doesn't stop there from being a potential shorter distance response. And this class of ideas may fall on the basis of that in a way that I'll explain, which is the hemispherical power asymmetry. So if you take this subdominant component and you split it into two hemispheres, you will get a different amount of subdominant power here than here. And so this is an example of what that value is. But that is below a much larger power spectrum associated with the dominant inflaton-induced term. So this may be fine, but the critical issue is the anomaly in this region compared to the anomaly in this region, because there is a hint now that the amount of power asymmetry at high L is quite small, sub-percent anyway, maybe smaller, and this is an issue you will see in the revised statistics and isotropy paper with Planck. We are treating it as we speak. And here is where the 7% number arises. If you take those skies and you rotate it so that you go to the region where the power asymmetry is maximal, then it looks even more startling in terms of the asymmetries in power. Again, let me remind you that it's a subdominant change. So it could be that this idea of super bias on the zeta field will turn out to die on the basis of the power asymmetry data. Now, obviously, what you could do is suppress it, but it is a different mechanism than the modulation mechanism that people have been discussing before, because it's an independent random field with this biasing function. So I think it's a fairly generic possibility, not just I think that, you know, in terms of randomly coming up with models, it's as good as any of the modulated models to look at. And so you want to explore it until it crashes against the data and can't beat it. At high L. Yeah, but that's still very much in play. And the thing is, we haven't explored it enough. I was exploring it explicitly for this talk, but we still have a lot to think about there. Jim may already have the answer since he's my good statistical buddy over here. But so the interesting question is, with this kind of power, with the transfer functions associated with the CMB you pass it through, with the fuzziness of the last scattering surface, can you get a relative suppression of the high L's relative to the lower ones? But the lower ones still have a phenomena over quite a broad range. You know, we're talking about up to 400 or so with this large asymmetry. Well, with those kinds of patches, yeah, because they would both be feeding in to the large-scale structure. I mean, that's the thing, and that's what happened. If you look at it, and I don't know why people haven't commented on this more. They probably have. Maybe Martin has. I don't know. Which is that, you know, I'm looking at the sky, and I'm saying, okay, if I were choosing to be an octopole, I would try and do this. If I were choosing to be a quadrupole, I'd try and do this. And sure enough, that's what the data is. That is to say, it is those regions which are breaking through the plane, which are driving that solution. And so then the question is, what are those? Are they intrinsic on the sky? And is that a phenomenon? The other aspect of this, which I really shouldn't be getting into, but you know me, I'm just going, which is that it appears that there is a bona fide phase coherence associated with those entities, and that that has also been explored to a high degree in the Planck paper. And so they're all just intimately related issues, in my view. And it speaks towards a grand unified theory being out there to explain this. It may be that the grand unified theory is some kind of unknown solar system emission, but at the moment, there is nothing that says that it's against a primordial origin. And the picture seems to be that flatness in delta T works pretty well. Okay. I won't talk about this. One of the themes in KITP was taking potentials and flattening them, and there are lots of mechanisms that have been used over time. And one of the things that does for you is to satisfy the RNS constraints of Planck, and yet at the bottom, it might look like a lambda phi to the fourth. So lambda phi to the fourth, as you know, is ruled out, but with the flattening of the potentials, which can be generic in many models, you get by that, and yet you still have phenomenology that can lead to this intermittency thing that we're talking about from preheating. Okay, I'm going to skip over this because I must show you a bubble picture, and I probably have... Is it really zero? Okay. So I was going to show you the caustic story because it's really neat, but I'm going to skip over it. While I'm skipping over it, just marvel at this 2D potential with this direction being the inflaton potential, this being the isocurvature direction, this being a range of initial chis, and then this is what happens as the one is in the ballistic regime and it propagates. And this is one measure of the response. Spaghetti, huh? Well, actually, there's memory, but... here you get these spikes, and so you get this incredible curvature structure which agrees in detail, in absolute detail, with the fully nonlinear lattice calculations we do, all understandable in terms of caustics. Caustics in variables ln A on uniform Hubble surfaces or uniform comoving density surfaces, that's the measure of zeta, by d chi. That is the thing that is associated with caustic formation. Anyway, it works really well. Okay, I'll say a few words about the bubble gospel because we have some bubbly people, not just in terms of spirit, but also people that really like bubbles in the audience and have worked on them extensively. And many in the audience, Kleben only because he wrote a review. So let me quickly go... Well, actually, shouldn't really. Okay. I'm going to say, for every aspect of the bubbly gospel, we have some comment associated with these three-dimensional field calculations, which are nonlinear. We are not saying anything against the bubbly gospel, but we're saying that there are tweaks to everybody's comments that come about when you add the full 3D. And the basic reason for this is because whenever you have a bubble, you expect that in the interior of the bubble, there are quantum fluctuations, and those fluctuations will intrinsically be able to lead to instabilities. Okay, and so here are some calculations associated with tunneling. We have been trying to add, the original work we did had inflation, or sorry, had the bubbles associated with tunneling, but without in an inflationary context. And so now we're trying to embed this in an inflationary context with a direction with some height to it associated with inflation. So these are isocurvature directions, and this could be a really small potential. Here is a characteristic scale M, which is associated with post-bubble things, and that is really important in terms of the kind of structure that you get. There are other kinds, thick walls. Oscillons can be produced, which are 3D nonlinear field configurations that have stability that can last for a long time. All of these things we see. And so here's a movie. Here is a collision without interior fluctuations. Here is a collision with interior fluctuations. Here they hit here and started to propagate. And you see that you get these sort of concentric outflowing rings of energy. But look what happens here as time goes on in terms of the fluctuations. They start to build up and create unstable phenomenology. And in many circumstances, we can get that to be long-lived oscillons. So the first thing that happens is there's a lot of scalar radiation that comes out. Secondly, there are a lot of oscillons. Anyway, it's kind of neat, and it's something that is usually not included in anybody's calculations. Oh, this was a similar figure, so I won't show it. No, what have I done? Yeah, okay, here it is with inflation, but it doesn't look dramatically different. That is to say, you embed your idea of doing these little tunnels in an overall inflationary framework, and you still get the instabilities in here, and it looks much the same. Details a little bit different. And there are lots of possibilities in terms of the potential that I was plotting relative to the inflaton flow direction. And I can't resist saying, does the observable universe use double Hubble bubble viciousness? That is to say, it's another form of CMB intermittency. Only at a very cursory level. So what is true is that the oscillons and other things, their self-gravity is not important. The issue is when you're connecting one bubble to another, whether or not approximate methods for treating that are good, and we think that they're good enough, but in an ideal world, you would do everything self-consistently. It's just non-trivial. Okay. Okay, and then I love axionic directions, and so here we have a axionic direction with the cosine, and we have energy going across the cosine. It's doing kink anti-kink instantons, and so this is the angular direction. It's propagating, it's oscillating up and down as it goes back and through this cosine, and then it reaches a point where the fluctuations start to have gone nonlinear and become important. And so you can see in all of these circumstances, anybody who's thinking about these things in terms of maximal symmetry, think again. And then the question is, are there observable possibilities? And so that should be my conclusions, if I can ever get there. Yeah. Conclusions. Highly nonlinear field evolutions happened. It is inevitable. End of inflation, bubble collisions. Inevitable, more or less. Do they lead to observable rare events, CMB, or small-scale structure, large-scale structure, ultra-large-scale structure anomalies? And the methods for this involve light isocons, directions relative to the overall inflaton flow. There is an interesting role for heavy isocons as well. And the heavy can lighten up as the evolution occurs. In fact, we made use of that a very long time ago. So the isochrons can be modulators. They can modulate couplings. They can determine tunneling that can lead to phenomena associated with grander inflation. You can get oscillon behaviors. You can get short-lived fuzzy strings as well as the very long-lived strings, all of these from these other degrees of freedom that presumably are floating around. It may be that the outcome of all of this, because of direct confrontation with data, is the best we will be able to do is just use it to do weak constraints on multi-field potentials, greater than the horizon fields, nucleation rates, etc. Amusing subdominant parameters do arise, however, and it's a pretty neat area to explore, and it can really only be done numerically. I had something pithy here. Ah, yeah, here is pithy. The characteristic oscillon 3D scale is a few divided by the mass scale, which is the curvature at the bottom of the potential for the isochron. And the isochron is decoupled from the inflaton, so you've got lots of degrees of freedom to play with. And so then the question is, can it be an observable thing? The characteristic scale then is M over H inflation, when you first created those bubbles and they started to propagate in that expanding overall inflation. The tunneling rate is going to obviously depend upon the height of the barrier and the width of the barrier of the isochron, but that's the isochron direction, which is not controlled by the overall inflation. So it's possible to conceive of bubbliness not being such an extremely rare thing, which is what we were used to argue for. Also, we used to argue that this M would not lead to observable things. And if you're looking at the microwave background and you were looking for the influence of bubbles, that the characteristic M associated with oscillons or something like that would essentially be fuzzed over by the resolution that you look at when you look at with a microwave background. But we are now changing that tune because we think that there can be situations in which that, in fact, because it is controlled by M over H in the initial state, it could be that there will be remnants of that history that could be observable on the sky. And then the challenge would be, if it's there, why wouldn't it be super duper dominant as opposed to extremely subdominant, which is probably the problem with most of this intermittency class of issues, that it should have maybe slapped you over the head if it's there, but you know, you got to look for these because we now have the data and that's the end of the talk. Sorry about that.